Israel, as policy, fully supports and assists settler intimidation tactics that often result in the loss of Palestinian farm and pasture land, says Israeli rights group. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Middle East Eye. This article is titled, "The Zionist Regime Uses Settler Violence as Tool to Take Palestinian Land." Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime has been using settler violence as a major informal tool to take over Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, a leading Israeli rights group has found. B'Tselem, in a report released recently, said that Israel uses two main methods to confiscate Palestinian land in the West Bank: official annexation via its judicial system and unofficial acts of intimidation and violence carried out by settler population. The state fully supports and assists these acts of violence, and its agents sometimes participate in them directly, the Israeli rights group said in its report. As such, settler violence is a form of policy aided and abetted by official authorities with their active participation. According to the report, Israeli settlers have taken over 11 square miles of farm and pasture land in the occupied West Bank during the past 5 years. Using 5 case studies to illustrate how continuous systematic violence meted out by settlers is part of the Israeli regime's official policy. B'Tselem said Israel is using settler violence to drive a massive takeover of Palestinian land. One of the case studies documented an illegal outpost known as Ma'on Farm, which was erected illegally in the southern West Bank and consists of about 1 square mile of land. Settlers have harassed, beaten, and otherwise intimidated the Palestinians that have historically used the land for pasture and farming, resulting in confiscation. Juma Rabi, a 40-year-old shepherd from Al Tawani village, told B'Tselem that settlers had been, for years, working to push his family off the farming that sustains them. In 2018, settlers attacked and beat Rabi, leaving him with severe injuries. He told the rights group, "They broke my leg and I had to spend 2 weeks in hospital and continue treatment at home. I had to sell most of our sheep to cover the cost of treatment." According to B'Tselem, Israel legitimizes settler violence both by legalizing their informal land grabs and by failing to even attempt to prevent or prosecute such violence. B'Tselem found the military avoids confronting violent settlers as a matter of policy, although soldiers have the authority and duty to detain and arrest them. As a rule, the military prefers to remove Palestinians from their own farmland or pasture land rather than confront settlers, using various tactics such as issuing closed military zone orders that apply to Palestinians only, or firing tear gas, stun grenades, rubber-coated metal bullets, and even live rounds. It continued, "Sometimes soldiers actively participate in the settler attacks or look on from the sidelines." Muayyad Besharat, programs and project manager at the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, told Middle East Eye that settler attacks against Palestinians have increased this year, particularly during the olive harvest season, which runs between October and November. The olive harvest is a lifeline for some 80,000 to 100,000 Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. This year's season has been the hardest in recent memory, according to Bishara, to accompany farmers during harvest as an observer. Echoing Bethlehem's report, Bisharat underlined the difficulty Palestinians face in attempting to combat settler attacks and land grabs, given the frequency in which settlers are accompanied by army escorts. While Palestinians regularly document and report settler attacks, both legally and via tools such as books, research reports, and documentaries, the Israeli regime almost never takes legal action against settlers. Israel's inaction continues after settler attacks on Palestinians have taken place, with enforcement authorities doing their utmost to avoid responding to these incidents, Bethlehem wrote, adding, complaints are difficult to file, and in the very few cases in which investigations are in fact opened, the system quickly whitewashes them. Indictments are hardly ever filed against settlers who harm Palestinians, and when they do, usually cite minor offenses, with token penalties to match in the rare instance of a conviction. The group found, in all, the lack of action has translated into de facto approval. It said, state violence, official and otherwise, is part and parcel of Israel's apartheid regime, which aims to create a Jewish-only space between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. The combination of violence, nominally unofficial violence, allows Israel to have it both ways, maintain plausible deniability and blame the violence on settler rather than on the military, the courts or civil administration, while advancing Palestinian disposition. The facts, however, blow plausible deniability out of the water. When the violence occurs with permission and assistance from the Israeli authorities and under its auspices, it is state violence. The settlers are not defying the state, they are doing its bidding, it said.
On Thursday, January 29, 2004, a plane carrying Lebanese prisoners landed at Beirut's airport. 4 years of indirect negotiations between Israel and Hezbollah had reached a conclusion. The prisoner exchange had taken place, and Hezbollah had been able to free more than 400 Arab and Lebanese detainees from Israeli prisons. This was a great victory for Hezbollah. All regional media outlets were covering every single moment of the celebration. But at the event, there was an empty chair. The chair belonged to the only Lebanese prisoner who had not been released. The only Lebanese prisoner who the Israelis had explicitly refused to release. Regretting it in the future only meant one thing: taking Israeli prisoners again. It was a difficult and complex operation which the Secretary General had announced to his jihadi forces in front of the cameras of different news outlets and not in secret. The operation would be directly planned and executed by his jihadi deputy, a man who very few people knew, a secret named Haj Radwan. He was born in 1962 in Beirut's Shia neighborhood. His father owned a small restaurant, and his mother, who was a pious woman, would hold religious studies classes for the ladies in the neighborhood. He was the first child of their small family. He grew up and went to school in the same neighborhood. He was 13 years old when their normal life was suddenly turned upside down. 1975, a civil war broke out between left and right-wing parties. The war tore Beirut apart in two sections. Many of the people who lived in the neighborhoods where the war was being fought left their homes and took refuge in the villages. He, along with his family, was forced to move to his father's ancestral village in the south. This unwanted migration made him more familiar with Palestinian groups. He underwent initial military trainings in Palestinian camps and became an official member of the Fatah organization. Upon his return to Beirut, because of his intelligence and courage, he made great progress in Fatah and became a member of the Elite Forces 17, an intelligence force at the heart of the Fatah organization, which was responsible for the personal security of the leaders of the organization and combating Mossad's activities. He became familiar with Imam Khomeini with the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He, like many other Muslim youths, slowly became captivated by Amarja, who had defeated the Shah of Iran with empty hands. His concern was the liberation of Palestine and had made Islam the basis of his government. On June the 6th, 1982, when Ariel Sharon gave the orders to attack Lebanon, he had traveled to Iran as the bodyguard of Sayyid Mohammad Hossein Fazlullah. They had come to Tehran to take part in the conferences of liberation movements, but he also had a personal motivation, meeting Imam Khomeini. It was a dream that many Lebanese Muslim youths had in those days, but word of the Israeli attack on Lebanon cut the conferences short, and the participants quickly returned to Lebanon. He also went back to Lebanon after meeting with Imam Khomeini. When they arrived, the east of Beirut had been occupied and some neighborhoods were besieged by the Israeli forces. In their first attack, he and a group of his friends were able to destroy an Israeli tank and personnel carrier. Word of this attack caused the Lebanese army to open up a case against him, accusing him of fighting Israel. The case was filed under his real name, Imad Fayez Mughniyeh. After the occupation, Lebanon had become another country. Palestinian fighters had been expelled, a pro-Israeli government was in place, and the massacres of Sabra and Shatila had wiped away the courage of the people to resist. The days of absolute hopelessness and fear had begun. But in the fall of that year, an important event took place in the south. It was a rainy morning when a white Peugeot 504 sped its way into the Israeli military headquarters in the city of Tyre. There was a huge explosion, and a few seconds later, the building housing the Israeli forces came crashing down on them. In one day, in one attack, more than 100 Israeli officers and soldiers were killed. The attack became the biggest anti-Israeli operation in the history of the resistance. It was after this attack which Imad, as one of the main planners, began living in hiding. The 1980s were a difficult time for Western forces in Lebanon, and the name Imad Mughniyeh was word of mouth as the cause of these difficult days. Even though during these days he had his own independent group and organization, he used all his power to establish, shape, and strengthen Hezbollah. And his preference was to fight Israel with his own group, his own way, and with a free hand. Intelligence services from different countries were after his arrest or assassination. A ghost who would easily pass the borders of different countries, but they were never able to pinpoint his location. He had dedicated his life to the struggle with Israel. Thank you. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah became Secretary General, Imad became the leader of Hezbollah's intelligence apparatus and used all his experience for Hezbollah to have the upper hand when it came to the information warfare with Israel. This upper hand proved itself with the successful assassinations of Israeli commanders and the leaders of the Lahad Army. But the more significant event happened in 1997 when he was able to decode the imagery of Israeli drones, and with that he was able to cause the defeat of the Israeli Special Forces unit in Ansariya village. The Ansariya operation was the first time in Israeli history that its Special Forces unit had been defeated. A year after the Ansariya operation, Haj Imad became Sayed Nasrallah's jihadi deputy and chose the name Haj Radwan for himself. While maintaining his previous role in the intelligence apparatus, he also took over command of Hezbollah's military. It didn't take long before operations against Israel became more extensive and goal-oriented. He used the years of experience he had in the intelligence fight against Israel in military operations. He was a commander who would count on all financial and material facilities, but would never solely rely on them. Years later, Israel withdrew from Lebanese soil. This was the first time that Israel was forced to leave the areas it had occupied because of resistance operations. And again, Haj Radwan's name was registered as a leading role in Israel's historic withdrawal. But the story didn't end there. There were still many Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails, something Hezbollah could not ignore. Even though taking Israeli hostages was difficult and impossible, it seemed to be the only way to get the prisoners released. Haj Radwan was the commander of this impossible mission in the Sheba Farms. It was after this operation that negotiations to exchange prisoners sped up. 4 years of indirect negotiations between Hezbollah and Israel came to fruition on Thursday, January 29, 2004. 439 prisoners and 59 martyrs were exchanged with a Mossad officer and the bodies of three Israeli soldiers. This left only one Lebanese prisoner in Israeli custody. This was why Hezbollah's Secretary General promised more hostage takings in the ceremony to welcome the prisoners. It was obvious that he was counting on the capability and power of a commander who had spent his entire life fighting Israel. Haj Radwan had to carry out the operation at a time when the enemy had put its forces on total standby. He chose an elite group of Hezbollah's best forces and held difficult and clear-cut training sessions for them. He was present for the trainings because he wanted to personally make sure that the operation would succeed. On the morning of July the 12th, 2006, Hezbollah forces were able to pass through the border barriers and take two Israeli soldiers hostage. unprecedented event, the Israeli Prime Minister ordered attacks on Lebanon. Israeli fighter jets bombed Lebanese cities and villages from the south to the north. Then, by relying on their spies, they targeted Hezbollah's missile launch pads, not knowing that they had once again been tricked and fallen in the trap of Hajrat 1. In the previous years, he had allowed Israel to identify centers where Hezbollah had its missiles so that Israeli intelligence capabilities would focus on these unreal targets. The general staff of the Israeli military directly informed the prime minister of the destruction of these targets and congratulated him on winning the war. But exactly the next day, more than 100 missiles were launched at Israeli settlements. After that, and for weeks, the Israeli Air Force was bombing Lebanon indiscriminately, only with the hope of destroying Hezbollah's launch pads. And on the other side, Hezbollah missiles were targeting occupied Palestine, including Haifa. This caused the commander of the Israeli forces to decide to launch a ground attack on Lebanon by counting on their Merkava tanks. But Hajrat 1 and the other resistance commanders had already predicted the attack. Hezbollah fighters used Hornet missiles and broadside bombs to block the path of the Israeli attack. In the end, after 33 days, the Israelis gave in to a ceasefire without being able to get their hostages back or destroying Hezbollah's launch pads. And this was how the longest war Israel had fought ended in its defeat. Two years after the 33-day war, the Israelis were forced to release Samir Qantar and other prisoners that Hezbollah wanted. Haj Radwan was not present on that day, but he had planned the hostage-taking operation in such a way that the Israelis were not able to know whether their hostages were dead or alive, even after he was gone. On July the 16th, 2008, the prisoner exchange deal was implemented. An operation which was adorned by the name of martyr Haj Radwan, a man whose name is registered in history alongside Israel's greatest defeats.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
The joint military maneuvers that are underway in the Red Sea region involving the UAE, Bahrain, the US, and the illegal Zionist entity have been aptly called a dagger in the heart of Al-Quds, Palestine, and all the nations of the region. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading "The Arab-Israeli Dagger Aimed at the Heart of Islam." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The joint military maneuvers that are underway in the Red Sea region involving the UAE, Bahrain, the US, and the illegal Zionist entity have been aptly called a dagger in the heart of Al-Quds, Palestine, and all the nations of the region. According to a senior official of Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, these nefarious naval exercises encourages the Zionist enemy to carry out further acts of aggression against Lebanon and Palestine, and is a stain of shame on the foreheads of the leaders of the normalization with the Zionist regime. Hujjatul Islam Nabil Gauk was not exaggerating. He was simply pointing to facts by noting the bragging to reporters of an Israeli naval that such military cooperation under U.S. auspices could help counter Iran in the region. What has the Islamic Republic of Iran done to become the target of the U.S. and its accomplices in the region, the ruthless and unrepresentative Arab regimes, and the Zionists? Nothing wrong except calling on regional countries to rid the region of extra-regional forces in order to establish sustainable security cooperation and coordination. As a matter of fact, the Arab-Israelite alliance, whether covert or overt, is not a new phenomenon resulting from the so-called Abraham Accord of the U.S. that emboldened the UAE and Bahrain to establish open diplomatic ties and exchange ambassadors after funding Takfiri terrorists to destabilize Syria, branding Lebanon's Hezbollah as terrorists, backstopping Palestinian Muslims, and vilifying the Islamic Iran for its selfless efforts to foster Islamic unity for the cherished goal of liberating Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. In the light of historical realities, this unholy alliance has always been a dagger aimed at the heart of Islam and Muslims ever since the time of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had blunted this dagger by expelling from Medina the treacherous Israelite tribes of Banu Nadir and Banu Qunayqa, which then ganged up with the pagan Arabs to launch the abortive Battle of the Confederates. He then broke the Arab-Israeli alliance into pieces during the famous campaign of Khaybar, thanks to the flashing blade of his cousin, son-in-law, and vicegerent Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. In due course, the Israelite tribes of Arabia and die-hard pagan Arabs felt no other choice other than paying lip service to Islam, but they never became true Muslims and turned out to be hypocrites, harboring malice deep down in their hearts against the solidarity of the Ummah. With the illegitimate birth of Israel on Palestinian soil in 1948, when several Arab Muslim countries started their joint campaign to nip the Zionists in the bud, The hypocrite serving Anglo-American imperialist interest schemed to turn the tide of the war from victory into defeat, a scenario that was repeated in 1967 and 1973 before reaching climax in 1978 at Camp David, U.S., with Anwar Sadat's scandalous accord. The grand victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 and the dynamic measures of Imam Khomeini in designating the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as Islamic Unity Week, and the last Friday of the month of Ramadan as Quds International Day for mobilizing world Muslims for the campaign to liberate Palestine horrified the hypocrites, who now clung more firmly to U.S. apron and under its cover to the Israeli regime. As Iran braved the illegal American sanctions to emerge as the paramount power in the region by working closely with like-minded independent forces in Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Yemen, and elsewhere, the hitherto covert Arab-Israeli alliance was encouraged by Godfather U.S. to come out into the open. It is now the major threat to the security of independent countries of the region, especially Syria and Iraq, which have defeated a devilish plot by the Americans, the Zionists, and the Arab reactionaries. It is, however, not invincible, as the conspirators make it out to be. It could be defeated provided the heads of the countries of the region come to their senses and realize the avowed enmity of the Israelites against Islam and the hypocrisy of their allies, the ruthless and unrepresentative regimes of the Persian Gulf.
When one hears the name of the textile industry, the first thing that comes to mind is the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. That's partially true, but it turns out that textiles have many uses outside of the fashion world. They are an important part of the medical field, toy manufacturing, weaponry, agriculture, and other unexpected fields. The Industrial Revolution indeed expanded this industry over the years. All textiles are made of fibers, and innovation, speed, and flexibility have built the spinning sector as we know it.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week we will explore the vast textile industry with a particular look at synthetic fibers. We wanted to see where this industry gets its raw material by looking at the contributions of petrochemical sector. We will uncover how synthetic fibers are made and why they are such an integral part of other upstream industries. So let's start spinning this show.
This week, our journey took us to an industrial complex in the town of Karchak near the capital Tehran. We wanted to see who helps tie the textile industry together, so we visited a manufacturer that specializes in producing synthetic threads. Nasojan Parse Mehris was first established in 2016, and its main product is polyester thread. Its massive production hall has the capacity to produce tons of this item each day. Its products are sold to numerous textile companies across the nation. Mainly, its customers are manufacturers of fabrics for curtains, upholstery, and the garment industry, to name a few. Production all starts with polyester granules, which are made by the petrochemical industry. Partially oriented yarn is made from this material. Dozens of people are employed at the production lines to work in shifts around the clock. Production never really stops at this facility. Partially oriented yarn is a term used to describe a polyester thread that is not completely stretched. This creates a less uniform appearance and is used to make texture in fabrics. This company makes different types of threads which are used for different purposes in down-the-line industries.
Well, there are two main steps to making polyester thread. In the first step, chips are fed to a machine called the vacuum dryer. After roughly 12 hours, the moisture is reduced and then the material is fed through a hopper to an extruder where it is heated and melted. After other steps, it is fed to a machine for pulling. Each step requires accuracy and precision to make high-quality threads.
The beating heart of this company is the quality control unit. Here, threads are tested for their strength and uniformity based on specifications of its productions. The results are then grouped into three categories based on their quality. The highest grades are then packaged and released into the market. Because of Iran's strategic geographical location, this company easily exports its products to Turkey and competes with other big exporters, such as China and India. This manufacturer's main claim to fame is the high quality of its thread. With such large productions, this company is eyeing the expansion of its production facilities. It has already implemented a second phase of production expansion, and the feasibility study for the third phase is in the works. These developments offer numerous investment opportunities as well. Most of the raw material needed to make polyester threads are domestically produced, with the exception of the spin finishes. The majority of finishes need to be imported. These oils are used because of their properties for increasing thread performance and processability of polyester yarns. These features add value to threads, which makes spin finishes a vital ingredient in the production mix. However, the U.S. imposed sanctions have made importing this item difficult over the years.
Polyester has gained a significant role in the textile industry. Some 50 years ago, cotton was the most important fiber in this industry. But over the years, this changed. Population growth meant prioritizing food crops, which decreased the area for cotton cultivation. So demand for polyester fibers grew such that it is now called the king of fibers in the textile industry.
At present, the most important raw material in the textile industry is polyester. It dominates 60% of material used in the textile production cycle. This is followed by cotton and then a small amount of other natural fibers, such as wool and silk. Other synthetic fibers, such as acrylic, nylon, and polypropylene, are also used in this industry, among others. The main raw material used to make polyester threads are granules, which are produced in large amounts in the petrochemical industry. Domestic polyester granule production is dominated by a handful of companies with a combined annual production of over 420,000 tons. That's according to the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. This amount is largely set for the making of polyester threads and is said to be enough for domestic needs. The petrochemical industry also produces other granules, which are used across almost all industrial sectors. Last year, Iran's total thread production stood at around 48,000 tons. 25% of the raw material used in this production was from cotton. That's based on figures from the National Textile Association. The country makes a lot of cotton, but it is still not nearly enough to meet demands. The domestic demand is roughly around 120,000 tons of cotton annually. This is why local productions last year stood at around 60,000 tons.
Polyester is derived from polymers made by the petrochemical industry. It's not surprising that Iran's polymer industry is exponentially expanding given its large oil reserves. Various manufacturing sectors such as the textile industry, plastics, and even automobile industry, are heavily dependent on petrochemical products. So how are productions in this sector doing?
Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. That's based on statistics from the National Plastics and Polymer Industrial Association. Of this amount, some 3 million tons of raw material are exported with a value of $3 billion. The other half of total productions is domestically used to make added value products. These items include polyester string, fabrics, tires, dishes, and containers, and a whole lot more. In total, the association puts the combined exports of petrochemical and polymer products at around $12 billion. Iran's Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union predicts an increase in added value of petrochemical products. The union estimates products made from petchems will reach a value of $18 billion in exports by the end of this year. The government has implemented policies and initiatives to increase added value through industries that use these raw materials. All in all, there are numerous opportunities in this sector and the ever-growing textile industry. It is an industry that has built a bridge between past and present with an eye on the future.
It's now time for my colleague on the field to take over the show and teach us all something new. Take it away.
Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, springs began being mass-produced around the turn of the 19th century, paving the way for quick and innovative advancement. An improvement in the production of steel meant that it could be made relatively cheaper, allowing the usage of springs to expand at a rapid pace.
In our day-to-day lives, we use a lot of products that utilize springs to achieve their desired motion. What I can think of on the spot are the tiny springs we see in our pens and biros. Now, springs, because of their variety, are also a perfect example of how materials can be manipulated for different applications.
Sazeh Fanarpuyesh is one of the big production companies in Iran that specializes in spring manufacturing. The rise of computer-aided design and drafting has made custom-made creations and cutting down on time, energy, and waste possible. The same CAD software that can be used to design springs big enough to support entire buildings through an earthquake can also create 30 micrometer sized versions for medical use.
A variety of CNC spring machines are used to manufacture extension springs. Now, typically, we use springs to apply an opposing force wherever we need it. Now, in these machines, by making slight adjustments, you can create springs with different tensions in line with the customer's requirements.
Variable factors, including wire composition, coil diameter, and the amount of external force, can be changed and calculated automatically to allow designers to come up with suitable, cost and time-efficient manufacturing designs. The coil spring manufacturing process involves feeding a wire into a set of rollers that pull the spring wire into the wire guides. The said wire then comes into contact with a coiling point that coils the wire backwards, forming a pigtail. New discoveries, such as how heat treatment strengthens certain ferrous metals and alloys after being coiled, allows numerous industries to expand the spring's application.
A heat treatment oven, and it's the standard equipment in most metalworking facilities. Now, what happens is that springs go into this oven and they are heated to an optimal temperature, and then the cooling process is completely controlled. This helps relieve the stress of the springs. Therefore, it's quite natural that sometimes they are referred to as stress-relieving ovens.
Although a spring may seem like a minor component within a large device, functional failure of the spring could result in a device's complete malfunction. Since many products rely on the durability of their springs, it is crucial to select high-quality ones that will not fail prematurely.
Typically, springs are tested to ensure their performance. For example, the device we have to my left is a spring fatigue testing machine that measures a spring's ability to withstand forces in a loading cycle. And the one you have behind me ensures the power of a spring, that the spring can deliver what it says it will. And of course, the device is a salt spray testing device that actually tests the durability of the spring's coating.
Protective coatings are often the most cost-effective method to prolong spring life in corrosive environments. Spring versatility suggests that the manufacture and use of spring technology isn't going to slow down anytime soon.
Over the past few decades, the demand for minuscule springs has risen dramatically because of their use in mobile phones, touch pads, and of course other modern electronic devices. So even after thousands of years of evolution, spring technology could have a future that's completely different to what it is today. Who knows, maybe even 4D printing and 2D materials will play a hand in it.
Thank you for that amazing reporting. We're just about out of time, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in the textile industry. Ever wanted a pair of socks that remain odor-free? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company which specializes in making nanotextiles has been producing them for years and is now exporting this product.
This company makes a special textile used in these socks, which is antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-odor. This product was mainly produced for diabetic patients who are susceptible to foot ulcers. Recently, this company began exporting its nano socks to neighboring countries as well as European states. Last year, some 8,000 pairs of these advanced socks were exported to Britain alone. Iran has made big advancements in the field of nanotechnology and is ranked fourth in the world for its high-quality nanotech products.
As you know, sportswear is a hot topic as many people are aiming to reach their fitness goals and stay healthy. Now, a special type of fabric has been created for the first time in Iran, which has cooling properties and is used to make activewear.
An Iranian knowledge-based company used nanotechnology to produce nylon fabrics that cool down the body by reflecting infrared radiation. These nanocomposite fabrics have many functions, including eliminating odors, rapid drying, and increasing blood circulation. The product received nanoscale certification from the National Headquarters of Nanotech Development 2 years ago. It is now part of the Healthex fabric collection manufactured at this nano company.
Silk thread produced in Iran has been used to make clothing fabric and for weaving Persian rugs for millennia. And ancient methods of silk making are still alive among many village communities across Iran.
Traditional silk makers are mainly located in northern Gilan and northeastern Khorasan Razavi provinces. These communities make a living off of this trade the same way their ancestors did some 3,000 years ago. They get their silk cocoons in wooden boxes, mainly from the northern provinces. The cocoons are soaked in hot water to loosen the filaments. Then the threads are hand-spun around spindles. It's a labor-intensive process that can take up to 12 hours to produce 1 kilogram of this valuable thread. While this process has become fully mechanized in many factories, traditional spinning methods still continue in these villages. These activities also offer interesting attractions for tourists.
And that covers our program for today. Let us know what you think about this industry by dropping us a line via email. Also, thank you so much for all the feedback on our Instagram page. Thank you for tuning in.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An investigation by The Intercept reveals that in the first months of the pandemic, only a small number of more than 6,000 hospitals in the U.S. let journalists inside, and when access was permitted, it was usually limited to a short time span. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Peter Moss, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How U.S. Hospitals Became Vaults That Hid Evidence of COVID-19's Toll. Stay tuned for more. An investigation by The Intercept reveals that in the first month of the pandemic, only a small number of more than 6,000 hospitals in the U.S. let journalists inside, and when access was permitted, it was usually limited to a short time span. The upshot is that most hospitals, citing safety and privacy concerns,